right, y'all. Welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/ScottHortonShow. All right, you guys, time to welcome Francis Boyle back to the show. Been a little while. International law expert and would-be expert witness for the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who were convicted at the end of October for their protest at the Kings Bay Trident submarine nuclear facility there. You might remember we had Elizabeth McAllister on the show just a couple of weeks ago, what, 3 days before the trial started, I guess, a few weeks ago. Well, they were convicted, and so Francis Boyle is here to talk about the trial and what comes next and all the rest of those things. So welcome back to the show, sir. How are you?
Well, thank you very much for having me on, and my best to your listening audience.
Well, great. I'm very happy to have you here, sir. So please remind us about the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who they are, and exactly what happened here that's at issue.
Well, these are religious people affiliated with the Catholic workers and also the Plowshares movement that was founded around 1980 by Phil Berrigan, Dan Berrigan, and Phil's wife, Liz McAllister, whom you've all already talked to. And they went on the Kings Bay Trident II nuclear weapons site that has the Trident II nuclear subs there on the East Coast. They got in there. They did what, you know, they call to be symbolic disarmament. They prayed and things of that nature. They were arrested voluntarily. They were peaceful, nonviolent. They did not resist arrest. And the United States government indicted them for depredation of government property, 10 years, destruction of naval property, 5 years, destruction of U.S. government property, 5 years. Naval property, conspiracy, 5 years, and trespass, 6 months. So I worked for Liz McAllister. She was represented by my friend Bill Quigley. Liz and I have been friends for many years, as well as her her late husband, Phil. And I've represented them in other contexts. The other Kings Bay Plowshares decided to represent themselves. And there were basically three approaches to defending them. The first was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is the first time ever, to the best of my knowledge, that such a defense was made in one of these Plowshares cases. And then the second, Dan Ellsberg put in an affidavit on the basis of his book, The Armageddon Machine, which I encourage you to read, outlining the necessity defense. And then I had a very extensive declaration. I think it's about 9 pages long. You can find on the internet at Institute for Public Accuracy, going through all the international law violations, criminal law violations by Trident II, and concluding that they really did not have the criminal intent necessary to constitute these crimes. And in any event, the government had to prove that criminal intent beyond a reasonable doubt. And certainly my declaration had created a reasonable doubt, and the charges should be dismissed. Now, on the Friday evening at 10 p.m. in the dead of night, before the trial was to open on Monday morning, the U.S. federal judge, who is a Bush Jr. appointee, by the way, I've dealt with them before, issued an order that struck them of all defenses. They could not make any of these defenses. And in addition, muzzled them as to their capability to raise these types of issues in their own testimony, and also threaten them and their lawyers with contempt if they did not, and other harsh sanctions, if they disobeyed her order. So after reading the order, I did put out a press release there of the Institute for Public Accuracy saying this is a kangaroo court with a rubber stamp on a railroad towards their conviction. And that's exactly what happened in court. You can read the transcript if you want at the Kings Bay Plowshare website. They were repeatedly cut off, interrupted. They were threatened with contempt, et cetera, et cetera. So not only were they stripped of all their defenses illegally, unconstitutionally, but they were muzzled and threatened on the witness stand. So, of course, they were convicted.
Yeah. Well, so, and of course, I just assume that the jury was full of not the peers of the accused, but the peers of the accusers, just like always, which is, you know, a big part of it, meaning government employees from the local area, probably as well. But now, I mean, I don't know. I guess if you give them the benefit of the doubt, maybe if they got to hear the defense's side of the story, they would have at least had a chance.
It's correct. And not only that, there's a good chance they would have been acquitted. I've worked on these cases before. The first anti-nuclear protest case I ever did for Pax Christi was 1982. The first Plowshares case I did was 1985. You can read about this in two books I've written, Defending Civil Resistance Under International Law, 1987, which I wrote for lawyers to use in these cases. And then later, another book, Protesting Power, War, Resistance, and Law, Rauman and Littlefield, Publishers, 2008. And when we've been able to get these arguments to the jury, we have been able to get outright acquittals or hung juries at least.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't realize that. Well, and I guess so that was going to be one of my other questions was, how often is it that the judges are this total in banning the defense from even being allowed to put on a case in this way?
It's typical in Plowshares cases, yes. They don't really care. They're, you know, federal judges here, they're just part of the federal system. And you have to understand that the Plowshares go directly at the heart of the American empire against the Pentagon. Indeed, the U.S. Department of Injustice has a special task force to deal with Plowshares cases, to monitor them, to direct the persecutions, I would call it, and always to go for the max, to go for the maximum charges and the maximum sentences. And that's been the consistent pattern that I've seen since doing these cases in 1985 for the Plowshares.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's break this down a little bit. When you say go after, they're doing symbolic protests. They're not truly threatening to disable any nuclear weapons or, you know, they're not cutting open the fence so that Al-Qaeda terrorists can sneak in. They're not doing anything other than creatively protesting and committing acts of civil disobedience to bring public attention to the danger of these weapons. So it goes to show just how important nipping even that is, nipping that in the bud is to the state, that they don't want it to look like any old nun can protest a nuclear weapons facility and get away with it ever because somebody else might copy her. And that's a pretty total stand to take against what on the surface is just kind of, you know, left-wing direct action protest tactics, which aren't really dangerous. It's not like they're breaking windows at Starbucks or something terrible like that, you know?
Well, everything you said is correct. Indeed, I worked on the case of three nuns there in Denver who went out to an ICBM silo site, cut the fence, went in there and prayed. And the federal government, it was, again, a total kangaroo court proceeding before a Bush Jr. judge. And they were found guilty of depredation and sabotage. And then the United States government demanded 30 years, the maximum, for both of them. And they were elderly. They were between, you know, 66, 67 years old. This would have been life in prison. And, you know, at the end of the day, they got short of three. So this is typical because the United States government understands this goes right up against the heart of what the Pentagon is all about.
Yeah.
And you go into these trials, these cases, which I have, you know, you're up against the Pentagon. That's who's really behind the Department of Injustice persecuting these people. Now, I would only make one correction there, Scott, to what
sure. You
said. This is not a case of civil disobedience. Going back to Dr. King and the American Civil Rights Movement, the courageous African Americans and others who supported them. This is a case of civil resistance in that the crimes here are being committed by the United States government in violation of international criminal law and U.S. domestic criminal law, including but not limited to the Nuremberg Charter judgment and principles. I outline these briefly in my 9-page declaration, which you are free to read. Also, U.S. Army Field Manual 2710, the Geneva Conventions, and other basic sources of international criminal law. So, and that gets incorporated into United States domestic law, the U.S. War Crimes Act, for example. So these people aren't disobeying anything. They are obeying the rules of international law, which are part of United States law, and also U.S. criminal law in trying to prevent the ongoing commission of crimes. And so they are the sheriffs. And the people running the Trident II system, they're the outlaws.
I think I just figured out why the judge won't let you testify.
Well, that's exactly right. And that was all set forth in my declaration, if you read it. But when we get these arguments to the juries, and I have enough time to present these arguments, and we can bring in an expert witness on U.S. nuclear weapon systems like Dan Ellsberg that we wanted to do here, we could usually turn around a jury and get an acquittal, if not, you know, a hung jury. Sure.
Yeah.
I've done it myself, by myself. Sure.
It's interesting. And I'm so interested in the topic of nuclear weapons and all the politics surrounding them and everything. And I'm just ceaselessly fascinated by how little anyone cares about this, except when it's a news story like this. But for the most part, these things are just out of sight, out of mind, even though everyone knows enough about them to know that one good one can kill a whole city, and that that's bad, and that at best, we've got a bunch of lawyers in charge of deciding when they should be used. The same kinds of soulless monsters that would put an old lady in prison for life for praying. at a facility are the same kinds of people who decide whether to use these or not. And so far, we've been lucky, but it just sort of goes without saying in our society, and I guess around the world, that, yeah, well, we're just going to all have, or not all, but many nations are going to have H-bombs pointed at each other from now on, the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the rest of these things you cite notwithstanding. And, anyway, what's for lunch? And nobody cares, really. They care more about TV shows than they care about H-bombs. And I'm not sure why. I guess, well, we all know we're powerless to do anything, or we feel powerless to do anything about it. That's a big part of it. But boy, what an emergency, you know, to think that these guys are holding on to bombs that are measured in the megatons when they detonate.
Right. And in the case of the Trident II, its use would probably destroy all humanity. These are, 150 kiloton bombs, maybe 10 times the size of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and many warheads, and it would definitely set off a major nuclear war between the United States and Russia and or China. And I don't think anyone would survive. Human life would be extinguished. And according to a scientific study, the only form of life that would survive are the cockroaches, because their shells would resist the radiation. So that's what we're dealing with. As for Liz McAllister...
Actually, hold that thought for just 1 second, because I should mention that, you know, there are less drastic scenarios for that that still include the deaths of billions of people and widespread famine and essentially the cancellation of human civilization back to Bronze Age levels and absolute catastrophe beyond anyone's imagination, but that, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere, some humans would be able to pull through, eventually, this kind of thing. So maybe it wouldn't be down to the cockroaches, but it would certainly be, I mean, without question, right? A war between America and Russia would mean absolutely, without question, would mean the end of all northern civilization on the planet, and certainly the destruction of billions and billions and billions of whoever's left after that. So anyway, I just, sometimes people hear things stated so totally and maybe dismiss it that, like, oh, I don't know, you could have a war where hundreds of millions or billions die, but maybe not all 8 billion of us, you know?
We would have brought Dan Ellsberg in with his new book that I would encourage you to read.
I haven't. I've talked with him about it numerous times, so, yeah.
I think Dan's opinion would have been using the Trident II nuclear weapon system would have extinguished basically all forms of life on the planet Earth and turned it into a radioactive wasteland for cockroaches. But that, you know, we could have had Dan address that precise issue. That's what we were going to do.
And hey, I'm with you. Everybody needs to read The Doomsday Machine. I mean, that thing will absolutely blow your mind.
Dan was personally involved in drawing up U.S. nuclear war plans. So he, you know, has enormous credibility here.
The reason I even bother to dispute is I actually have another friend. You might remember Gordon Prather from the George W. Bush years, wrote so much great stuff for antiwar.com debunking all the lies about Iran's supposed nuclear weapons program and that kind of thing. And he used to make H-bombs for Uncle Sam during the Cold War and knows a hell of a lot about it and says, like, hey, you know, if you survive the initial dose of radiation, you're far enough away from the actual explosions. You know, you're not going to, the radiation eventually dissipates from that. So you'd survive that. And then obviously weather patterns changing and crop failures and all those things, you know, I don't think he discounts nuclear winter altogether, but I think he also said that, yeah, some of those things might be absolute worst case scenarios too. So then again, I mean, I think if this is the low end of the sliding scale, that we're still talking about billions of deaths. We're still talking about catastrophe beyond anyone's imagination. That's hardly an argument for going ahead and hanging on to these things, you know.
Well, Dr. Helen Caldicott has written books on the dangers of radiation, and I think she would respectfully disagree with this person. Also, Dr. Sternglass has written a book on radiation, so I don't think we would have had much difficulty if we had a chance establishing in court that certainly the use of the Trident II nuclear weapon systems would have extinguished life on the planet Earth as we know it. But that, you know, you're welcome to read Dr. Caldicott and Sternglass.
Yeah, you know, maybe I should get her and or Dan back on the show to talk about that. And exactly, I mean, the Trident, we're talking about one missile with multiple warheads launched from one submarine. I mean, that alone could extinguish all life in France or something, but if you're saying that that would, if the use of one of those would mean an unstoppable chain of events that would lead to full-scale nuclear exchange between America and Russia or America and China, then that's a different question, right?
Well, I think it would, sure.
Yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't mean to bicker with you here. I'm absolutely on your side. And the idea that you would ever, that humanity can even entertain the possibility that we would hold on to weapons, that even the use of one of which would kill an entire city worth of human beings, is just absolutely unforgivably mad. So, not to coin a phrase, but anyway.
Right. Well, as I said, the systems on both sides, the United States and Russia, are on a hair trigger alert that can go off at any time. And even in the event of a computer malfunction or a flight of geese or bad satellite images or things of that. In other cases I've worked on, we have introduced evidence of repeated malfunctions on warning systems. Mm-hmm. So it's far more dangerous, I think, than most people realize.
Right. Yeah, there have been at least 20 extremely close calls to the absolute brink of war, which I'm not really good with math and statistics and stuff, but that sounds, you know, a cat only has 9 lives. We got away with 20 almost H-bomb wars over mistakes, right? Over a bomb that accidentally fell out of a plane, or a misunderstanding between the Americans and the Soviets over their intentions at different times, and these kinds of things. That's cutting it way, way, way too close. In fact, you know, my dad was at UCLA in 1963, and his professor disappeared for 2 weeks and came back and said, yeah, I was there advising the XCOM, and I'm here to tell you kids that this Cuban missile crisis is as close to nuclear war as we could possibly get without having one. That is the absolute brink of the crisis. The fact that we survived it is a miracle.
Well, and as a matter of fact, if you study all the literature on the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's exactly correct. We came within a hairbreadth away of nuclear war with the Soviet Union. That's correct. Indeed, I argued to that effect in Scotland, in a court in Greenock, Scotland, where three women went out and damaged a tender for the UK Trident IIs that we gave them. And I argued that exact point. If you're interested, you could see that my argument testimony at a website for Trident Plowshares, spelled the British way, Plowghshares 2000. And at the end of the day, we got a directed verdict from the judge of acquittal on behalf of all three of them for four different charges each on various different counts of destruction of property. And it even made the British press the next day saying our nuclear deterrent is illegal, which it is. We have to understand that despite all this nonsense about deterrence, that's a joke and a fraud. All our weapons, our strategic nuclear weapons, are designed for an offensive first strike strategic nuclear attack on Russia or China, or now other targets that we allege have nuclear weapons. And indeed, as you know, Dr. Michio Kaku wrote a book on this, the physicist, you see him on TV, called First Strike. And he goes through it all there, the number of times we've threatened or prepared for a first strike of nuclear weapons. So these weapons are not there to deter anything. They are there to be used in a first strike. Indeed, in a Plowshares case I worked up on Wisconsin, Tom and Don Howard Hastings, they had damaged the ELF towers that communicate with Trident II submarines, and they were both facing charges of sabotage. And we brought in a naval captain, retired. He used to command submarines, and he says it's well known that the ELF Trident II system will be the bell ringer for the start of an offensive first strike strategic nuclear war. Well, with his testimony and my testimony and my arguments, we got outright acquittals for both of them. So again, it goes back to the point when juries actually hear the destructive case. I mean, we're talking here about weapons that far exceed even the wildest fantasies of Hitler and the Nazis, if you study those two. These are Nazi weapons to the umpteenth time. And when juries get to hear that, and then that this is ongoing criminal activity, conspiracy, planning, preparation to commit Nuremberg crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes against peace, and outright genocide, typically they'll acquit. And by the way, the United States government knows that. The Department of Injustice knows that, which is why they fight so hard to keep my testimony out of there, and even my declarations, where even putting aside me testifying in court, which I was standing by to fly out there, even my declarations, my two declarations, they did not get to see, even though they're filed in court. Mm-hmm. The second declaration I submitted after the Trump administration pulled out of the INF treaty, and I itemized in that second declaration, again, which you can find on the Kings Bay Plowshares website, now the dangers that are facing us, that these INF weapons now will be deployed by the United States, first against Russia and also against China, and reduce warning time from the time they're set off to the time they land in either Moscow, St. Petersburg, or elsewhere, to maybe 3 to 5 minutes. So, and the same will be true with respect to China. So clearly they are there as part of an offensive first strike nuclear weapon system against Russia, against China. There's no question about it if you study the literature. And Dan would agree with me. That was the beauty. You know, if we had had Dan and me, it would have been the 1-2 punch there. But
well, it's always been clear, you know, for the project of putting the so-called defensive missiles in Eastern Europe, that was part of an offensive package. It was just meant to be able to shoot down their retaliatory strike to make it easier to launch a first strike in the first place.
The Russians are now pointing out that, in fact, we are putting Tomahawk cruise missiles in there, in those launchers,
right,
that are nuclear capable. And that therefore they have an offensive capability and not just are there for defense. And the Russians say, you know, if you do that, we will have to respond in kind. Yeah.
So now, I forget if it was at a G8 conference or something like that when George W. Bush said that, you know, it was like an aside, I think, at some international conference with a bunch of European leaders there and that kind of thing. And he says, well, you know, this is all just, you know, these missiles are going into Poland to protect from Iran. And the whole room just busted out laughing. Right. Everybody knows Iran doesn't have any missiles that can hit Poland and doesn't have any nukes and doesn't have a beef with Poland of all places. And what are you talking about? This is about Russia. In fact, I think Putin was there too. And they all just kind of had a laugh that, oh, that's what you're supposed to say, huh? Even though we all know on the face of it that this is for part of our policy of containing Russia in the new Cold War. Or worse, as you're saying.
Right. You have to be an idiot to believe something like that. And by the way, then, You see, this federal judge, the Bush Jr. appointee, she knew full well that if I was able to present these arguments to the jury, and Dan Ellsberg was able to present his arguments to the jury, there's a good chance we'd have gotten an outright acquittal for all of them. And that would have been a terrible blow against Trident II. So, of course, she just not only struck me, she struck Dan. My declarations never got to the jury. Dan's affidavit didn't. And the Kings Bay Plowshares were muzzled. You can read the transcript and threatened with the judge that if they began talking about these things, she'd hold them in contempt.
Well, now let me ask you this. Can you give us a bit of a summary of the religious freedom argument there? Because that was something that Liz McAllister had mentioned, but you were more specific. You said they were trying to invoke the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yeah, this was the first time ever the Religious Freedom Restoration Act was adopted by Congress to make sure that the United States government does not put undue burdens on people for motivated by religious reasons. And all they wanted to do here was to argue these points to the jury. That's what they wanted to argue. And the judge just stripped them of that argument too. So they were able to get up there and say, well, I was motivated for religious reasons, but they could not tie it into this specific statute that gives special protections for people who are motivated by religious reasons. So that was stripped of them. But the experts on that, they were going to bring in a Catholic bishop, since they are all Catholic workers, and a professor of theology, I believe, from Fordham University, which is Catholic. I wasn't really involved in that. It was a novel defense. Bill Quigley has said he's going to try to appeal that precise issue. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. All right. Well, how long until the sentencing is announced there?
I believe the sentencing will be in January. They each are facing 20 years. I suspect the Department of Injustice, pursuant to previous practice, will go for the max 20 years for all of them. And that includes Liz McAllister, who's about to turn 80. So effectively, that will be a life sentence for her. They tried to do this to her husband, Phil Berrigan, in his last plowshares action, DU plowshares, depleted uranium plowshares. And the prosecutor there publicly bragged that, you know, this is going to be Phil Berrigan's last hurrah. He's going to put Phil away for the rest of his life. We started out facing 40 years. And at the end of a kangaroo court proceeding, his trial attorney was my friend Ramsey Clark. Phil and the others got 2 years. And then he got out and was sent back on another plowshares action for probation revocation, I think another 6 months. So he did get out. And then soon thereafter, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer and died. But at least Phil Berrigan died at home, surrounded by his wife Liz and their children and their grandchildren and their friends.
Yeah.
And that not rotting away in some federal hellhole for crimes against the American empire. And that is what they're trying to do to Liz McAllister. That, you know, Liz has been a pain in their neck for the last 50 years since the Berrigans and McAllister launched their campaign against the Vietnam War. And they want to put Liz away for the rest of her life. And I don't mean to diminish the significance of any of the others, but Liz has been at this for over 50 years.
Hey guys, Scott here. I've got some books you should read. The War State by Mike Swanson, a great history of the early Cold War. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. how to run your computer business like a good libertarian. Oh yeah, and don't forget Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, by me. Hey y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show, and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver, is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past, too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to ScottHorton.org/donate. Hey, guys, you know, you probably need a new website. A lot of people do. What you need to do then is go to ExpandDesigns.com. The great Harley Abbott and his team over at ExpandDesigns.com, they'll hook you up with a great new website for 2019. And in fact, what you really should do is type in expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500. And listen, I have to say, I told her this too, that I've always known that there's this nun or a group of nuns and priests that do these actions and break into these nuclear weapons facilities in order to protest and bring attention to them. And that's not exactly the same thing. And I guess they're Catholic workers, you know, party background or whatever, but it's not exactly the same thing as just a bunch of, I don't know, hate Ashbury hippies or something like that. It's a priest and his wife? Huh, okay. And then, I never knew a lot about it, right? But I'm just talking about like in my childhood, essentially all my life growing up, I knew that these people existed and that they did this and that they went to prison to make this point. And that, you know, along the lines of, in fact, this was on the anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination, that they did this action and that it was part of that tradition. I know you talked about the discrepancy there. Arguably, segregation itself was an illegal regime too. This stuff is really important. It's one of the things that got me interested in the subject as a young kid, and I know I'm not alone in that. So I don't know how much that's worth, but it's not nothing, I guess, you know, for all the sacrifice that they put into this.
It's important to understand their slogan is they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And that comes from the Jewish prophets Micah and Isaiah. And so these plowshares, many of them are Catholic, but not all of them, are motivated by the example of the Jewish prophets. If you go back and read your Bible, and the role they played, and if challenging the king at that time, the Jewish emperors at that time. And, many of these prophets were killed or imprisoned. And if you are interested in following that up, there are two books. Dan Berrigan, the late Dan Berrigan, a Jesuit, wrote a series of books, commentaries on the Jewish prophets. And then Rabbi Abraham Heschel, now deceased, but he opposed the Vietnam War and supported civil rights for African Americans and marched with Dr. King at Selma, you know, my kind of rabbi. And he wrote a book on the Jewish prophets, too, to if you really want to understand what motivates these people. This was Rabbi Heschel's doctoral dissertation he wrote to get his doctorate in theology. So you can get these books, and the plowshares try to fit what they are doing into this biblical tradition of prophecy.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because all these political figures all pretend to be very religious too, but when it comes down to it, the state ranks far higher than God or his son on their list, no question.
Well, that's right. And as Liz McAllister pointed out, this is a religion of nuclearism, and it's an idolatry.
Cult of power, a cult of death.
Right. So she's been very eloquent about it for all these years. And of course, the other Kings Bay plowshares and all the other plowshares as well have tried to make this point the best they can in these trials. But again, the federal government and federal judges to a great extent, have muzzled them and completely shut down their defenses in violation of their rights of due process of law.
Yeah. And I mean, that's really one of the most outrageous parts of this, right? You know, for a guy who was raised on Matlock like me, I know that the state's going to almost always win. But when the judge and the prosecutors conspire to just strike down every witness that the defense wants to bring, and they're just not even allowed to put on their case at all, that's the kind of thing that should never happen in America, you know, and especially in a case like this, where the prosecution could afford to simply just be patronizing and insulting as hell and ask the judge to give them all 6 months and a nice $10,000 fine and make the point and shame them for jeopardizing our security or some kind of thing and let them go and treat this like a really bad misdemeanor, which is what it really is. And I mean, for them to go to these lengths to prevent even any semblance of a defense by these people who are clearly motivated by the highest purpose is, well, it's sickening. I don't know. I could have ended that a few different ways, but it bothers me. It ain't right.
Well, you're right, Scott, in that your listeners have to understand they were each facing 20 years. All they wanted were three witnesses. They wanted the bishop, the professor of theology on the religious defense, and then me on the nuclear weapons aspect. Dan could not come at the end of the day because of a prior personal commitment. So sometimes in that type of situation, I do double duty. I've actually been qualified in court as an expert on U.S. nuclear targeting doctrines and strategy. So I was fully prepared to do double duty here. And we were all stripped. That was it. They had no defense. The judge and the feds stripped them of all their defenses. So that's why I said it was a kangaroo court with a rubber stamp and a railroad. And sure enough, that's what it turned out to be.
Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I'll let you go. Thank you for so much your time here this afternoon on this very important story and all your great efforts. I wish you guys the best on all the appeals and all of this. And wish I knew something better to say.
Well, just thanks again for taking the time to go through all this so that people can understand what the plowshares are all about and that they are acting as they see it as prophets in the tradition of the Jewish Bible.
Right. All right. Well, thank you again, everybody. That is Francis Boyle, professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/scotthortonshow. Oh, yeah. And read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.